You are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
Today we're looking at another man who needed Jesus to take his place, but he could not. This man is a man that we know as Pontius Pilate. Around the same time that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, another boy was born. This boy, according to what we can tell in archaeology and history, was not born in Jerusalem. This was a boy born to the far west Iberian Peninsula, what we call today Spain and Portugal, that part of Europe, that western part of Europe. This boy was an ordinary boy, unknown as far as the history of that time. He was like any other countryside boy, growing up, dreaming of great and grand things. Perhaps he played with little toy soldiers in the dirt. He certainly didn't have plastic soldiers like you see on the screen and boys play with today. We actually were watching Toy Story this week with our kids, the original first one, when the kids actually looked very scary when you think about it. They were just learning their CGI techniques back then. We were watching this, and we asked the kids afterwards, what was your favorite toy in the story? And one of them said, the soldiers. All right, so maybe this was what Pilate was going through as a kid. Maybe he played with his little toy soldiers in the dirt outside his house. Maybe he watched as Roman soldiers marched through the streets of his village, or as they fought battles out on the surrounding hillsides. Whatever the case, as a young man somewhere along the line, this boy grew up and enlisted in the Roman army. He was inscripted. He was one of many, many soldiers in those Roman armies those days. At one point, he was a legionnaire who fought bravely and served the Roman Republic with loyalty and eventually arrived at the city of Seven Hills in person, the city of Rome. This was a child who was born into no place, who made his way up through life. And he arrived in Rome one day, and through careful maneuvering and a little bit of luck, and from his perspective, the favor of the gods, he ended up marrying the granddaughter of the emperor, Roman Caesar Augustus himself. This is the kind of trajectory, the kind of progression and life story that everybody here would like to be able to have for ourselves. To become this child who dreams big dreams and gets to accomplish them. How many boys who grew up in the countryside of the Roman Empire got to marry into the Caesar's family? Not very many. This was a boy on the way up. By the world's measure, he was a model of success, a self-made man, with perhaps the help of the gods, as they would view it, who climbed from the fringes of society to a seat of power, prestige, and influence. Yet one day he met Jesus, the Son of God. And a different story emerged. This encounter with Jesus on this day that we read about in John 19 revealed a fatal flaw in Pilate's achievements. It exposed the deathly grip that his ambitions held upon his soul. Through this encounter, Pilate would engage in the greatest battle of his military and political career, a clash between his boyhood ambitions and the heart of his soul as it faced Jesus Christ. Through this discovery that we're going to see today, we're going to learn that the truth about Jesus reveals the cruelty of worldly ambitions. The truth about Jesus reveals the cruelty of worldly ambitions. Ambition is a powerful motivator. How would you describe the word ambition? Dictionary.com says that ambition is an earnest desire for some type of achievement or distinction, such as power, fame, honor, or wealth. desire drives men and women to achieve all sorts of things in life. Some of these things that men try to achieve are good, some of them are bad. But the greatest problem with ambition is not whether it will lead you to pursue something good or bad. The greatest problem with ambition is whether or not it will drive you to choose something less than what is best. That is the problem. Choosing the wrong target. Consider Pilate. What likely began as a harmless desire to serve his empire with prestige and influence, which is a noble and significant thing to do, pushed him so far and grasped him so tightly that when faced with the opportunity, he chose to pursue something less. Somewhere, and this is important, I want you to get this thought today. Somewhere in his transition from boy to man, student to soldier, enlisted man to high-ranking officer, he crossed the line of no return. He traded away his soul for a temporary experience of limited and illusionary power. It is not wrong for a boy to have ambitions. It is not wrong for a girl to aspire to accomplish great things. In fact, if a boy and a girl has no vision to do something significant with their life, has no ambition, no goals, no drive, I would question what is going on in their hearts. Every child should dream big dreams and achieve big things for God. You are not made to do nothing. You are made to rule and to reign with Christ. You are made to have dominion in the world, to conquer, to overcome. Every single young person should have ambitions. But we also need to understand that ambitions can treat you cruelly in the end. As you follow your dreams and your ambitions, what happens is those boyhood dreams can become adulthood nightmares. If you allow those ambitions to push you away from the truth of Christ. Pilate in this story, John 19, affirmed the innocence of Jesus. I want you to follow this in this passage. He affirmed the innocence of Jesus, but succumbed to the political pressure of the Jews instead. It's a big point. When I put sermons together, I usually try to make the points short so you can remember them. But this is something we have to get our minds around. Roman soldiers and government officials did not enjoy a virtuous reputation. When you thought of a Roman soldier in the first century, you did not think of a really good, nice, respectable person. When you thought of a Roman soldier, you thought of someone who was brutal, someone who was rough and crude, who used foul language, who enjoyed violence, and if there was a job given to kill somebody, they were glad to do it. Roman soldiers were not known for virtue and justice. They were known for brutality, dishonesty, and immorality. Knowing this, it should surprise you that Pilate was concerned about the innocence of Jesus. This man, Pilate, his goal here in this trial of Jesus was to find a way to solve a crisis in a political way so that he could move on with his life and keep the city of Jerusalem out of his hair. And if that meant that a man died in the process, that was okay. He wasn't overly concerned about what happened to innocent people. Despite his depravity, despite his lack of concern, as any Roman soldier would have had for Jesus himself, there was something about this man that was different from anyone else he had encountered. And he recognized, in a way he had never recognized before with anyone else, this man, Jesus, before him, was innocent. What evil had he done? What crime had Jesus committed? None that Pilate could tell. The Jews presented Jesus to Pilate that day as a threat to the Roman Empire, as a man who is threatening to stage a revolution against the government. But after questioning this man, look back at John 18, verse 38. This is the first time, but not the last time, Pilate says this. He said, "I find no fault in him at all. What you're accusing him of, I see no evidence for. None. And I'm compelled to tell you that." Now, as far as Pilate was concerned, it would have served his purposes better just to go ahead and play the game, say, okay, so he's a threat, you say he's a threat, we'll kill him and move on with our lives. But there was something so innocent about Jesus Christ. He took a political risk to go out to the Jewish people and say, "I disagree with your accusation. This man is innocent. I find no fault with him at all." And that's not the first time that he did this. In verse 4 of chapter 19, he did this again. He brought Jesus back out to them a second time and said, "Okay, I find no fault with this man at all." He did this a third time. Look in verse 6. When the chief priests and officers said to him, saw him, they cried out saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, because I find no fault in him." Pilate was backed into a corner, faced for the first time with a human being that he was compelled to defend the innocence of. "I find no fault in this man. Stop asking me to kill him." Three times. Again, I remind you, this was a Roman official, not just a Roman soldier. This man had seen blood. This man probably has dismembered people in battle. This man has been stained with blood and showered the blood off of his body many times in his life. This is a man who knew gore. This is a man who knew the raw fringes of society. This is a man probably who had no nightmares anymore because he'd seen it all. His nerves were numb to violence, crime, and yet when he looked into the face of Jesus and heard the words of Jesus, he knew he was staring into the eyes of an innocent man. No threat whatsoever. And so three times he went out and risked his political situation to defend the innocence of Jesus. That is saying something. Today, there are many people in academic halls and in philosophical places who will say, "We don't think that Jesus was perfect. We think that Jesus was a sinner like everybody else." Not Pilate. And if Pilate defended the innocence of Jesus, we should too. Three times, he let this conflict of his soul bleed out into his public actions and defended Jesus. Yet even so, as much as we can appreciate what he went through to defend the innocence of Jesus, he did not allow the innocence of Jesus to move him strongly enough. There's a reason. There was something preventing Pilate from going all the way and officially declaring him innocent. Pilate could have stood before the Jewish people and said, "He's innocent, I'm releasing him, go away. On my authority, I declare this man is innocent and the case is closed." He never did that. Three times he defended the innocence of Jesus, but he was unable to release him. Why? It had nothing to do with whether or not Jesus was really innocent. It had everything to do with something that was more important to Pilate than Jesus himself. Something else was gripping his heart. first time that he defended the innocence of Jesus, end of John chapter 18, the Jewish people said, no, we will take Barabbas. Here's what he did. Instead of just coming out the first time and saying, I have made a decision, Jesus is innocent, I'm releasing him, the case is closed. He could have done that, but instead he decided to play a little political game. You ever play a game? Ever play a card game? Maybe the game of Uno or some kind of game where you hold your cards up in your hand and you're playing the game and you reach a point where you look at the person across the room or across the couch or across the table and you're convinced you have the best card and you're ready to make the move and you're ready to play your hand and you say, okay, I'm going to win. And you play your hand only to find out the other side had a better hand and you lose. Pilate felt like he had what he needed. He had the power, the position, and the strategy to make a winning move. And so he said, okay, let's play a game. I'm going to present to you today two men, Barabbas, a convicted criminal, a threat to society, and Jesus, an innocent man. In fact, you're saying Jesus is guilty of treason. Since you're so concerned about treason, I'm going to give you a criminal who is guilty of treason, and everybody knows it. So, take your pick. Which one will I release to you? And he was ready to declare the winner himself, and the people said, we'll take Barabbas. And he was stunned. What? Once you concede, friends, and you don't stand on truth itself, once you concede and start playing the game with the world becomes your authority. And you will continue to play that game. You will continue to spin on that carousel, and you're going to have a hard time getting off. When you know the truth sets you free. But when you play games with the truth and you go halfway with the world, you don't win. You compromise the truth. You put the truth at a disadvantage. And that's what happened to Pilate this day. He knew he had the winning hand, but he played a game with it. Sometimes we grow up in church. We follow the faith of our mother and father. And then we graduate. And then we decide, you know what, I'm going to stop going to church because right now, I still love Jesus, but right now I have to make my way in the world. And everybody else who graduated with me, they're working jobs and I'm going to have to work on Sunday now. Because I want to get that scholarship at that prestigious school downtown and I'm going to just have to deal with this for the next few years. And we drop out of church and we start going halfway. And then we persuade ourselves that we're reading our Bible every now and then, and we think about Jesus from time to time on the subway, but we're not able to actually go and participate. And we start going halfway with God. This happens so many different ways. There are so many scenarios. It's not just that one scenario in which in life we go halfway with the truth because there's something else we're wanting to achieve. Pilate went halfway. He started playing the game. And once you start playing that game, friends, it's really hard to stop. It's like gambling. You put $10 down, and you lose $11. So then you have to play $20. And then you lose $25. And then you're stuck hoping you can win the big one to fix all your problems. And the big one never came for Pilate. The big one was the first hand. And he ruined it. In response to this stunning reply, Pilate turned Jesus over to some Roman soldiers, beginning of our passage, beginning of John 19. Pilate then took Jesus. Let me ask you a question. Who's in charge? Who is wielding the power right now of this situation? The Jewish people out there in the courtyard. Because of what they said to him, we'll take Barabbas, because he agreed to play the game, now he had to take the next step. So he took Jesus, and he handed Jesus, not because he wanted to, not because it was right, but because he had to do it now because of the game he had started to play. Or his word meant nothing. He handed Jesus over to the Roman soldiers for a round of painful and humiliating torture. You read about it in the first three verses of John 19. One man says this about the word scourged. They scourged Jesus. In this form of punishment, the victim was forcefully brutalized with rods or whips that frequently contained leather thongs or straps fitted with spikes and bones and scraps of metal. When used, these whips would tear pieces of flesh off of the victim's body. The soldiers also mocked Jesus. They mocked him and they pushed a painful crown, a crown of thorns, onto his head, penetrating his skin and his skull. Then they grabbed a robe and threw it around him. Some say that it may have been a red soldier's robe that was so just beaten up over time and stained by the sun that it turned purple. They threw it on him. And in a sarcastic fashion, they mocked him as the king of the Jews. Look at this man. For these Roman soldiers, there was no theology at all that they were concerned about. These were men who were just glad to be off the streets. These were men who would rather be gaming with a criminal like this inside the safety of the palace than out doing security patrol with people running around secretly with knives waiting to stab them in the back. You see, if you were assigned to street patrol as a Roman soldier, there were Jewish revolutionary people, terrorists, roaming the crowds with little hooked blades under their robes looking for Roman soldiers. And every time someone would brush up against you, you would turn around. Because every brush against a person in the crowds in Jerusalem meant you might get stabbed. These Jewish terrorists would roam around the streets trying to take out Roman soldiers one at a time. They didn't use pipe bombs, they used knives. And they would slip up behind the Roman soldier where that armor was not, and they'd take that hooked blade, wrap it in behind the rib cage. They knew exactly what they were doing. They'd wrap it in, it'd go in, that curved blade, puncture the vital organs, they'd pull it back out and keep walking in the crowd, and you would drop to a pool of blood in the street. These Roman soldiers, they knew the raw fringes of life, trust me. They were glad to stay in the palace that day, to have a prisoner, and to beat on this prisoner instead of be out on the streets that day. They were having a good time as far as being a Roman soldier is concerned, beating this man, taking turns, making fun of him. To them, it was more than just beating this man, Jesus. It was also making fun of the Jewish people. They were not just making fun of Jesus. Oh, this is the man, the king of the Jews. Making fun of the Jewish people who were always complaining, always resisting the Roman government, always causing problems for the Roman Empire. The Roman soldiers had no high view of the Jewish people, and this was an opportunity for them to play around. And they played around with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. After this excruciating ordeal, Pilate was no longer innocent in this situation. Because he agreed to play the game, he now was guilty himself of what was happening to Jesus Christ. If he had released Jesus, he would have been innocent of this situation. But because he agreed to play the game, he now became guilty for the decisions he was making. Let me draw that parallel to us today as well. When you begin to play the game, you move from childhood to adulthood, and you begin to willingly compromise with the world. You're not still exploring and discovering and learning about Jesus. You know who Jesus is. You know what faith is. You know what it means to follow Jesus Christ, first of all, but you decide to play the game with the world. Once you start doing that, you yourself, Hebrews says, begins to crucify the Son of God afresh. You yourself begin to cause pain to the Savior as well. Don't play games with Jesus. Continue to follow him with all of your heart as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Pilate now was a guilty man. In response to the bloodthirsty request of the Jewish people, he had given Jesus over to be brutalized, and then he tried again. dealing with his guilty conscience, he brought Jesus, now bloodied and a shameful mess, out before the Jewish people. And as they looked upon this ghastly sight, he said, I want to give you one more chance, Jesus or Barabbas. And they said, Barabbas. What they saw on Jesus that day, and the blood coming through, and the brutality that had happened to him, did not pacify them. They didn't say, you know what, thank you. That was more than we could have asked for. Thank you for doing that to him. We'll end our case. That is not what happened. That's what Pilate wanted to happen. They said, give us more. Finish the job. Crucify him. He said, why? He's innocent. They said, crucify him. And that's when he said, you take him and crucify him. You go and do it. I don't find anything wrong with him. Pilate wished so strongly to be done with this situation, to get Jesus off of his hands. He was willing to break Roman law. Roman law only permitted Roman government officials to conduct a crucifixion. Jewish law forbade them from crucifying a criminal. Roman law forbade Jewish people from crucifying a criminal. But Pilate was so convinced of the innocence of Jesus that he was willing to say, you take and crucify him. You do it. He grew so increasingly afraid as the situation developed. He grew increasingly afraid, but he grasped onto the illusion of political power anyway. We see this development happening in this chapter. As Pilate affirmed the innocence of Jesus for a third time, the Jewish leaders changed the terms of their accusation. Did you notice that when we read this today? If you're following what we're looking at in the Gospel of John, you know that the Jewish people blamed Jesus for being a revolutionary threat to the Roman Empire. Pilate was making a clear case that he is no such threat. There is no violation of this kind. And so the Jewish people, you ever play Uno? And you use your wild cards? What's better than a wild card? You know what that is, right? It's the four-way wild card that has all four colors on it. They pulled out more powerful card. They said, actually, we're going to change our accusations. Now that we're all down the road, we're going to tell you why we really brought Jesus. If you're Pilate, you're standing there thinking, why are you telling me this now? After we've already done this and I've already had this man beaten. What did he really do? Now tell me the truth. Well, they said here, let's see, what verse is that? We have a law, verse 7. According to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. That was new information to Pilate. Quite frankly, Pilate was not interested in the religious laws of the Jewish people. As far as he was concerned, that was something for them to deal with for themselves. But when they said he made himself to be the Son of God, what does it say happened to Pilate? In verse 8, when Pilate heard that saying, imagine, this is a man pushing an innocent man. He just ordered an innocent man to be brutalized. He's already, his nerves are on edge. He hears this, and in verse 8, when Pilate heard that, he was the more afraid, which means he already was an afraid man. Pilate was not a happy camper on this day. His nerves were on edge. But now he was even more afraid. Is that true? Is it true that when any one of us plays games with the truth about Jesus, we go halfway with the world and we play this game with the world, isn't it true that we begin to get afraid? We begin to be more aware of God, not as a loving God who cares for our every need, but as a God who may judge us. we began to grow more afraid, less comfortable in our relationship with Christ. We began to hide things and be more nervous. We become afraid of our friends in the world and what they're going to do to us because we know they don't have our best interests in mind, but we've already started to try to build that bridge. But then we see how they betray other people, but we keep trying to be their friend. And then we look back at God, and we know that we've been doing wrong by Him as well. We began to grow afraid. John, in his later epistle, 1 John, writes, "There is no fear in love. Perfect love casts away fear. But when you step away from a close, loving, trusting relationship to Jesus and the truth of God, fear begins to set in." Another way of looking at this is that Proverbs teaches us the fear of man brings a snare, a trap. When you're afraid of what other people are going to say and do to you, like Pilate was this day, you begin to grow afraid and snared, trapped, unable to actually do what needs to be done, unable to actually make real progress. Pilate became increasingly afraid, and there were at least two reasons for that. First, like any Roman, he would have had a superstitious belief about the pantheon of Roman Greek gods. If you've ever studied mythology in school, you know what I'm talking about. Stories of Roman gods and goddesses having battles up in the sky, these were real things to the Roman people. Stories of human children of the gods, of a god having a child to a human person and having this kind of halfway child going on. You had stories like this. Or even human beings endowed with special divine powers. There are many stories like this in Roman traditions, mythological stories, fanciful stories. There were many stories of gods coming down and looking like they were human and walking around and being mistreated, so they would go back up to the sky and send a flood to wipe out the valley. Stories like this were very prevalent to the Roman people. So here is Pilate, a good Roman. He has just ordered an innocent man to be brutalized by Roman soldiers on his authority. And now he's being told that this man made a claim to be this kind of divine human figure. Now he was more afraid. What would the gods do to him? To make matters even worse, his wife, the night before, had a dream. And during this whole series of events, which John doesn't describe this detail, Matthew tells us about it, during this whole series of turmoil events that Pilate's going through, his wife slips into the courtroom and she walks up. She whispers to him, "Honey, by the way, whatever you're dealing with here, that man over there, yes, that man, trust me, I know about that man. I have enough to do with this man today. Hey, have nothing to do with him. Do not accuse him of anything. I had nightmares last night about this guy. This is bad news, honey." Pilate's probably sitting there saying, "Thanks, that's not what I wanted to be hearing right now." This man was on edge. On top of that, we're getting closer and closer to the point, I think, of this passage, of this message today. Apart from these things, look at verse 9. Look what he said. He had Jesus come back to him. Jesus is all bloodied and battered here. He says, "Jesus, where are you from?" What did Jesus say? Nothing. He didn't say anything. Why didn't he say anything? See, Pilate was not saying, "Are you the Son of God? Are you definitely the Messiah of the Old Testament come to take away my sins?" That is not what he was asking. He just wanted to know, "Are you from the realm of the gods? Do you know Zeus? Do you know all these people up there? I mean, are you one of them? Did I mess up here?" And Jesus just kept his mouth shut. Jesus, back at the end of John 18, had already explained to Pilate where he was from. He said, "I came into this world to be a king, but not the kind of king that you need to be afraid of. I didn't come to take out the Roman Empire. I came into this world. My kingdom is not from this world. It is from above." He's already explained this all. Jesus did not go through it again. He remained silent. There was another reason why Pilate was afraid. If the Jews staged a riot over his handling of Jesus, and word of the unrest on this day, whether or not it was legal or not, if words of unrest reached Augustus's ears, all of Pilate's boyhood dreams and adult ambitions could come crashing down. As he stood there that day and realized the mess he had gotten himself into by playing this game with the Jewish people, with Jesus, if he went out and he told the Jewish people, number one, this man is innocent, I'm releasing him. Number two, the thing that you're accusing him of, actually, that you just told me about, finally, is a spiritual, religious matter from your own religious books. It does not concern me. You are supposed to go and handle this yourself. If you want to stone this man according to your religion, go stone him. I have nothing to do with it. This is not my jurisdiction. He could have said that. The problem now was, if he did actually go and follow his own laws, the Jewish people were at a point where they would have rioted and caused a great stir in the city. And Pilate's job was to keep the city quiet. Back in those days, the Caesar of Rome could change governors like you change your socks. If one day the Roman Caesar decided, I don't like what I'm hearing over in Judea, take the guy out. He could say that. And your whole life's profession is gone in a moment. Think about that. The boy playing with the soldiers, watching the men out on the hillside, month after month, year after year, finally leaving family and enlisting, fighting bloody battle after bloody battle, putting your neck on the line over and over again, barely coming out with your life, walking out from that heap of bodies alive week after week, shower after shower in the brook, washing the blood off of your clothes. And finally, being one of the few who makes it back to the city of Seven Hills. And by the fate of the gods, making it to the very family of Caesar himself. And then receiving the prestigious position of going to another faraway land and representing the Roman Empire as governor of that region. That didn't happen overnight. There was literally a lot of blood, sweat, tears, manipulation, and a bit of luck to even get to that point. Statistically, it was a very small likelihood that he would ever even get that chance. And he was having that chance. He had a palace. He had a royal wife. He had soldiers at his beck and call. And these crazy Jewish people out there in the courtyard are about ready to make this all go up in smoke if he doesn't keep them happy. And he knows Jesus is innocent. And he's terribly afraid about this whole situation. His mind is all messed up. But at the end of the day, Pilate valued his earthly ambitions more than the truth about Jesus and God's eternal kingdom. When push came to shove, even though he had stuck his neck out three times for Jesus, that was a political risk in and of itself. Now, he should have done it the first time all the way, but three times. At the end of the day, he wanted to remain Pilate, governor of Judea. He was not going to risk his political fortune for Jesus, no matter how innocent this man was. Pilate valued his earthly ambitions more than the truth about Jesus and God's eternal kingdom. Remember back at the end of John 18, Jesus explained to him. He peeled back the blinds and let the light shine in and gave Pilate a glimpse of another kingdom, of another empire of which he could be a part. Follow me and you'll have eternal life. You'll be part of a kingdom that will stand forever, a kingdom that is from above. Try walking down to Washington, D.C. today, or go down to the mayor's office downtown and try to explain to them that though you respect what they're doing for our nation and for our city and the effort they put in every day to make our world a better place, a safer place, there is another kingdom. And they need to make that the priority. They'll look at you like you're crazy. They go home to their penthouse every night. They walk around and they get free rides on state money. They have power. They have prominence. They have name recognition. They're a politician. They pass laws. They control your life. Why would they want to listen to what you're saying about this imaginary kingdom that you can't even see? That's for the lower classes of life. That's for people down there who need religion. We don't need it except for when we need to talk about it to get ourselves voted for. Pilate didn't get it, which is why the second time that this topic came up, Jesus just kept his mouth shut. Notice what Pilate said in verse 10. Jesus gave him no answer, so in verse 10, then Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me?" He was frustrated. Essentially what he's saying here is, why aren't you saying anything? Why aren't you talking to me? Don't you know who I am? And what he says next, at first glance, sounds like a statement of power and authority. But if you read between the lines, you find out this is a statement of weakness. This is a statement of a man grasping for his last breath as he falls over the waterfall. This is the statement of a drowning man, not a powerful man. He says, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you? Don't you know who I am? I'm the Roman Pilate. Why aren't you listening to me? Why?" In his own mind, I can imagine him saying, "Why isn't anyone listening to me around here? My wife is telling me what to do. The Jewish people are telling me what to do. This man, he says he's from the realm of the gods, won't even talk to me. Doesn't anyone know how much power I have?" You know this. Some of you know this. You've been taught this in different ways. When someone has to remind you about how much power they have, they don't have very much power. And that's where he was at. This is true of any Caesar of Rome, in fact. You know the stories. You know what happened to Julius Caesar, the great and famous Caesar of Rome, don't you? When he laid in a pool of blood, stabbed by the senators of Rome. It was dumb. The Roman Empire did not have a king. You understand that? It didn't have a king. And we're going to talk a little later in another sermon about the king part of this whole passage. It keeps coming up, and I'm not ignoring it. When the Jewish people said, "We have no king but Caesar," that didn't make any sense because no one called Caesar king. Not even the Roman people called Caesar a king. He was simply the Caesar of a republic ruled by the senators. The only power any of those people had was the power that people let them have. What kind of power is that? What kind of power does anyone have in the American Republic? They only have power if you can vote for them, right? You get the votes, you have power, but it lasts for how long? And then you end up in Congress or the House of Representatives and you're not sure, you know, who has the most power here. There's so much going on. What is power? It's more of an illusion than a reality. And yet people spend so much time trying to get it. And when they get it, they can't let go, even when it's already gone. And they open their hands and realize they weren't holding anything. That's where Pilate was at. "Don't you know that I have power? I am the only person around here who has the power to let you go." Well, if you were Jesus or any person in his situation at this point in time, you might be asking yourself quietly without saying it out loud, "Well, if you have the power to let me go, then why haven't you done it yet?" And that's a good question, right? If you have this power, where is it? Because I've been beaten. I've been tortured. I'm being played a game with. I'm a game piece in whatever is going on here from a human perspective. Where is this power? Friends, the only person with power in this whole situation was the prisoner. The only person who is free in the city of Jerusalem at this time was the prisoner, Jesus Christ himself, freely going around doing and saying whatever he decided to do. Before Pilate, he could keep his mouth shut or talk. It was all the same to him. We know according to the Old Testament that according to the prophet Isaiah, he willingly gave himself. He willingly took the torture. He willingly took the crown of thorns. Willingly took the abuse. Willingly laid down his life for you. A free man. Not once was he in bondage. Every act, every wince of pain was freely given for you. And it was this man, Pilate, with so much power, who was imprisoned by the tentacles of his own ambition. Look any politician today in the eyes and ask yourself the question, are they free? How much blackmail is on them? What are the repercussions that they actually do what they say they're going to do? You don't know. A lot of people have been elected these days to do some things. They're going to all show up at their jobs start of next year. And who knows what goes on in those closed rooms when they actually sit down and talk. Are they really representing you? Are they acting freely according to the dictates of their conscience? Once you receive power in this world, you find out it's not what it was. It was not what it was promised to be. You ask that businessman who, from a kid, makes his way all the way through high school to business school, makes it to the top of a Fortune 500 company and sits in the glass office somewhere in Manhattan and looks over Wall Street from his back window. Let me ask you a question. How much freedom does that man have now? Everywhere he goes. The expectations. You never know who your friends are anymore. The press is jumping on every bad word that you say. Where is the freedom? True freedom, friends, is found in following Jesus Christ, never veering away from that, and being okay with whatever happens as a result. You know the truth, Jesus said earlier in John's Gospel, and the truth will set you free. And whom the Son sets free is free indeed. Don't you know, he says, who has power here? Don't you know I am the only one? What does Jesus say in verse 12? Or verse 11? You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. The only power you have, Pilate, is the power God lets you have. By the way, any person in American government today who has any position, regardless of what party they are in, has power and is the power that God is letting them have. Remember that. God is letting them have it. And that's it. And wherever the lines are, that's God's line. A kid gets money from their parents, an allowance to go to the candy store. Whatever that money is that's put into their hands, that's what they have. If it's $10, it's not $20. When God allows a person in this world to have power, they have power. But there's a limit to that power. And the parameters are set by God. So when you are ever a victim of misused power, remember, God is still in charge. And there is an end to that. If you fight and resist that, you put yourself in a bad place. But if you submit to God and continue to go about your business living according to the truth, you remain free. Verse 12, from then on, notice how Pilate was able to use his great power. He looked for a way to release him, but the Jews cried out. If he had so much power, where was it? I don't see it. If he had the power to release Jesus, where was it? He went around looking for a way. Imagine, he says, don't you know I'm the only person with power to release you? And then he goes and figures out how to release him, and he can't figure out how to do it because he actually isn't able. His power is nothing more than a dream. It's an illusion. It's fake. And yet it was so real to him, he couldn't sacrifice it for Jesus. It was nothing at all. When the rich man dies with cash clenched in his fist, it stays in his fist when his soul goes on to God. It was nothing at all. And today, our wealth isn't in our fists anyway, unless you're the few that keep it under your mattress. It's all online. It's all virtual anyway. So what is it? It's already nothing. People just say you have it, and they let you exchange it through algorithms on the internet. But what is it? It's actually nothing, and it never has been. What really matters is the truth about Jesus, and are you willing to follow that? He said, it's really hard because of my friend. What are your friends? It's really hard because, you know, my job. What is your job? It's really hard because my position. What is your position? It's not what you think it is. Open your hands and look. What is there? Nothing but a body that God himself made. And that's the God you answer to. Pilate couldn't get that. He still thought he had power. And then he ran around and tried to figure out how to use it. But the only power that he could find was all the people yelling out at him in the courtyard, crucify this man. And he eventually had to give in. Because his power was worthless. No matter how much Pilate wanted to defend the innocence of Jesus, his thirst for ambition was stronger. Verse 13, when Pilate heard that saying, what saying? The Jewish people reminded him of the powerful card they were still holding. If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. And so what they're saying is, we are going to report you to Rome, buddy, and you're going to be in big trouble, and you are going to be done. Your career is going to be over if you don't do what we say. And when he heard that, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. When Pilate heard that saying, he brought Jesus out, sat down in the judgment seat, and by the way, that word judgment seat is the same word that is used of the judgment seat of Christ. Someday Jesus is going to sit down on the judgment seat. And Pilate's going to stand before him. Who will have the power then? The same one who had it here. When you read this story and you soak up the details and you immerse yourself in what's going on, what you find out is this is not a trial of Jesus. This is a trial of Pilate, and he doesn't even know it. Because he's the one standing with robes and rings and crowns on him. And the man before him is bloody and bruised and beaten. But he is the one who is the judge. He is the king. Do you see the trap of human ambition? In the end, all the powerful characters of this story would come to ruin. Pilate, history tells us, even for all of this, it wasn't long after he got in trouble for something else, and the Caesar didn't like it, so he removed him from his position, placed him in exile, and that was the end. Stuck in exile, dead end for the rest of his life. Pilate committed suicide. It was all an illusion. The Jewish people, Well, the Jewish people, they were sacked by the Roman government in AD 70. Their entire city was wiped to the ground. Their temple was demolished, and all their religious leaders were killed. Where were the crowds then? And even the Caesars themselves died, one after the other after the other. Where is the Roman Empire today? There's a few busts of people's heads and chests, and some of their noses are chiseled off from battles that have happened around them. That's about all that's left of the Roman Empire today. By the way, study the book of Revelation, which John also wrote, and he describes for us how the Roman Empire will try to come back to life again. And guess what happens then? Jesus is going to take over. The question I have to ask you today is, are worldly ambitions preventing you from following Jesus? Take your boyhood, your girlhood dreams, write them down on a piece of paper and ask yourself the question, if I follow these all the way to the end, what are they? Are they real things? Do they really matter? And when they contradict what it means to follow Jesus Christ, am I able to put Christ first? There's nothing wrong with becoming a politician. There's nothing wrong with becoming a financially successful person. There's nothing wrong with achieving big things in this life. But along the journey of life, from childhood to adult, you're going to have to make a choice. Jesus first, or Jesus last. And that choice may or may not shut down opportunities for you. Sometimes it doesn't shut down. God keeps opening up doors and you become very successful. Sometimes you have to say yes to Jesus and this or that, and it feels like a dead end. But that's okay. Because who's the king anyway? Do you really know? It's Jesus Christ. All the ambitions we chase after in this life are nothing more than a transitory experience on a sinking ship that's sailing fast towards destruction. Notice what it says in Matthew 6:24. Jesus, his own words, said, "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be loyal to the one and despise the other." And Pilate chose Rome. And Pilate lost. Notice what John himself wrote in 1 John chapter 2. "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, including," and I'm emphasizing today this one, "the pride of life, the desire to be something, ambition, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it, but he who does the will of God," what? "Abides forever." The book of Daniel, chapter 2, verse 44, says, "The kingdom of God stands forever." Make the choices that line up with Jesus. I know I was mentioning going to church today. Why would you let pursuing a career, take you out of church for 3 years? Why? "Well, I got to study for my classes." If your classes are that consuming, you need to figure out something about your classes. Right? And there's so many ways in life. What does Jesus say in Scripture on any number of things? That always has to be first. You follow what he says, and sometimes there's a cost to that, and you have to set other things aside. But it tests who you love. And when you chase after the things of this world, notice what it says. The world is passing away. The way that's written in Greek, that word in Greek means it is actually passing away this moment before your very eyes. Right now, some of you are getting ready to have a big career ahead someday. You're looking for that. You're dreaming about that. You want to buy a house? You want to buy a car? Did you know if those things exist, they're already falling apart? So whatever house you're planning to buy, it's already falling apart. Did you know that? It is. the company you're going to be hired by is already in the process of eventually closing down. Did you know that? They're sitting in the office today trying to figure out how to prevent it from falling apart. It's true. The entire world. You say, ah, I got you, Pastor. I want to buy a brand new car, and that car hasn't even been made yet. Well, that's if the company still exists when they get around to making this car that you say you're going to buy. Everything in the world is falling apart. It's like trying to hold an ocean in the palm of your hand. Only God can do that. And He can, the scriptures say. It's like trying to hold the sands through your outstretched fingers. And as Pilate stood there and his whole life's ambitions were in the palm of his hand, he thought, he said, I'm the only one who has power. And then he looks and there's nothing there. After a whole life of working towards it. And Jesus himself, though beaten and bruised, still held all the power. He told his disciples after he died and rose again, all power is given to me in heaven and earth, and I am with you always. The pull of the world, the allure, the illusion, the mirage is real to our eyes, but it's not real in eternity. Go on and do big things in life. Dream big dreams. Accomplish big things for God. But do it for God. And don't ever compromise truth in the process. When you start doing that, you jump on a carousel that has a hard time stopping. And it gets worse. And you can get off by the grace of God. But you jump off of a moving carousel, you get a little beat up, don't you? You can get off. Pilate couldn't. What is your ambition? And are you letting it pull you away from Jesus Christ?
Thank you for tuning in to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church. We are conveniently located in Corona, New York City, and are devoted to loving God and making disciples. For more resources and helpful information about our church, visit studygodsword.com. We'd also like to extend a personal invitation for you and your family to worship with us on Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning, followed by a luncheon and an uplifting time of interactive Bible study for teenagers and adults after that. If you have young children, they will really enjoy our exciting Bible-based children's ministry that also occurs in the afternoon session. If you have any questions about the church, or would like to learn more about how to have a personal relationship with God, please give us a call or leave some feedback at studygodsword.com. We would be thrilled to meet you in person and show you firsthand what God is doing at Faith Baptist Church. Until next time, may God richly bless you.